Hey everyone, I'm Kurt Bruner, your host, and welcome to this special edition of the podcast. This one's designed to help parents who are getting ready to have the talk. You know what I mean by the talk. Actually, two talks. First, we're going to talk about that process where we prepare our children for adolescence as they're entering the beginning of puberty. In fact, that usually occurs around 11 years old. At least it did with our children. Sometimes a little younger, a little older. Depends on the boy or the girl and their process of development. But there does come a point where you can tell, okay, hormones are starting to kick in. Maybe they're at the beginning or about to enter the beginning of bodily changes. And so I need to talk to them about it. I need to prepare them for it. And the second talk is when they're a little bit older. They can occur at the same time, but usually they're a little bit older and you're talking to them about purity and what that means, especially as they enter that season of life where they become particularly interested in the opposite sex. And so you want to talk to them in advance so that they make key decisions about purity as they enter that season of life. I remember when I took my oldest son, Kyle, he was about 11 years old, for our Preparing for Adolescence chat. And I kind of set it up saying, hey, we're going to go off, we're going to have fun, and then we're going to have some conversation, kind of man-to-man conversation. And he got a little bit of a nervous look on his face because I think he sensed, you know, his radar was up. Well, what kind of conversation? I don't think he wanted to have that conversation. And it's awkward for both the parent and the child, so you just have to push through that. But I said, well, you know, there's some things we need to talk about. And he said, well, Dad, I already know. And I said, well, what do you mean you already know, and how do you know? He says, well, Alex told me. Well, I thought, drats, you know, I've been preempted by an 11-year-old buddy. I says, well, let's go ahead, and I just want to make sure that, you know, whatever Alex said was right and that you understand some other things that I think are important for you to know. So we went off, and we had fun. We did some things together. We went off to dinner, and as we were at dinner talking about the details of kind of where babies come from and so forth, I looked at Kyle, and he had an odd expression on his face, and I said, so, Kyle, is it like what Alex said? And he looked back and said, Dad, it's nothing like what Alex said. Well, as parents, it's our job to make sure that they get it right, that they get the right information and that it's framed properly from a Christian perspective and God's design for them as a future husband, a future wife, future parent. So this edition of the podcast is designed to make that process a little bit easier because this is one of the most awkward moments a parent faces, and yet one of the most important opportunities for instilling a Christian perspective on our humanity and on our sexuality. So how do we do that? Well, first of all, as you plan this conversation, the timing is very, very important. They usually are ready for the talk younger than you're ready to give the talk. So probably, we suggest probably around 11 years old is when you should really seriously plan to have at least the initial phase of the talk. And then perhaps wait on another part of that talk, which would be about purity, when they're a little bit older and perhaps becoming interested in the opposite sex and maybe approaching those years where they're seeing their friends go out on, you know, dates or whatever it may be, so that they can make commitments to purity right before they enter that season of life where it becomes very, very important. In fact, this might be a good place to mention the idea that you might want to consider waiting as long as possible before you allow your child to begin dating at all. And here's why. One study showed that if a young woman begins dating at 12 years old, she only has about a 9% likelihood of being a virgin when she's 18. Versus if a young woman waits till she's 16 to begin dating, the percentage goes up dramatically that she will be able to remain a virgin. And that's because we're wired a certain way. We're wired for relationship to the other sex. So why begin something long before they could possibly ever consider marriage, which is what dating is supposed to lead to? So what I thought would be best would be to introduce to you a couple of gentlemen that have helped me. First of all, Dr. James Dobson. I worked for him for 20 years. He was a mentor of mine, but he years and years ago produced a resource, a book, and then an accompanying audio resource called Preparing for Adolescence. Terrific tool. In fact, I've recommended many, many parents use this as they plan their excursion or their outing or their activity with their son or their daughter. And here's why. What he does is he actually gives the talk on a number of topics, from peer pressure to bodily changes to how babies are made and some other very awkward conversations. He does it from the perspective of a clinical psychologist, so he's very straightforward. And yet from a Christian perspective, so he frames it in a way that I would want it framed. And the beauty of having these audios is as you drive, at least for me, as we would drive to whatever our destination was, we would listen to them together. We're facing out the car window rather than looking at each other during some of the more awkward moments. It's being said well, so I don't stumble or stammer or get it, you know, wrong because I'm trying to be less direct or whatever it may be. And so we're just listening together, and some of the difficult things get said, and then we have a meal together, we have a Starbucks together, whatever it may be, and we unpack and talk about that as it relates to our specific child. So that's how I did it with the initial conversation of preparing for adolescence. Went very, very well. In fact, now in three instances with my children, my three older boys, I've done that. My wife with my daughter. And in listening, they get all the information, and then we move on and we talk about it. So what I want to do is share several minutes of an excerpt, a couple of excerpts actually, from Dr. Dobson's conversations on a portion where he's talking about our bodily changes and how they relate to God preparing us to become parents. And the reason I share these segments is because I think they're most helpful for two things. First of all, to get a sense of that resource in case you may want to use that in your plan. But secondly, to just listen to how he describes it, because if you're going to do it yourself, you'll get a sense of just how direct you can be, how you can frame it in such a way that it's healthy and appropriate and beneficial. So what I want to do now is transition. We're going to listen to several minutes of Dr. James Dobson talking about bodily changes. He's going to start with the boy, and then he's going to talk about the girl. And the idea is that both are listening, you and the child together, and then you'll unpack it and talk about it. So here's Dr. James Dobson in the Preparing for Adolescence audio series.
Okay, what can you expect to happen during early adolescence, and how will it all take place? The most important change that you'll notice is that your body is going to begin to prepare itself for parenthood. Now, notice that I didn't say you're about to become a parent. That ought to be years away. But I said that your body is about to equip itself with the ability to produce a child. That's one of the major changes that occurs during this period. The correct name for this time of sexual awakening is puberty. And what we want to talk about is how that transformation takes place. First, let's discuss what happens to boys, and then we'll talk about girls. During puberty, a boy begins to grow very rapidly, faster than ever before in his life. And his muscles become much more like those of a man, and he'll get much stronger and better coordinated. Now, that's why a junior high school boy is usually a much better athlete than a fifth or a sixth grader, and why a high school boy is a better athlete than a junior high boy. You see, a dramatic increase occurs in his overall body size and his strength and his coordination during this period. Secondly, hair appears on the boy's body and begins to look more like the hair of a man. He'll notice the beginnings of a beard on his face. Now see, all of this is caused by these hormones. There's a hormone that comes from the pituitary that sets all this in motion. It causes the beard to begin to develop and hair in other places. And that boy's going to have to start shaving every now and then. Hair will also grow under his arms for the first time, and also in what's called the pubic region, or what you may have called a private area, around the sex organs. Now the sex organs themselves will become larger and more like those of an adult male. These are evidences that the little boy is disappearing forever. He'll never be back. And in his place will come a man capable of becoming a father and of taking care of his wife and family if he chooses to get married. Now, this fantastic transformation reminds me in some ways of a caterpillar, which spins a cocoon around itself, and then after a while it comes out as a totally different creature, a butterfly. Of course, the changes in a boy are not that complete and not that dramatic, but he will never be the same after undergoing this process of maturation, which is the medical word for growing up. Now, this period of rapid change is just around the corner for many of you, perhaps the one that I'm talking to right at this moment. Now, the frightening thing for some kids is that these changes occur very suddenly almost overnight. The pituitary gland begins kicking everything into action, and it barks these orders right and left, and your entire body seems to race around inside trying to carry out those commands. Everything is affected. Even your voice will be different. I'm sure you've noticed how much lower your dad's voice is than your own. Have you ever wondered how it got that way? Was it always deep and gruff? Did it always sound like a foghorn? Can you imagine your dad in his crib as a baby saying, "goo, goo," in a deep voice? Of course not. He wasn't born that way. His voice changed during puberty, and that's exactly what will happen to yours, too. However, an adolescent boy's voice is sometimes an embarrassment to him until this deepening process is finished, because it doesn't sound very solid. It squeaks and it screeches and it wobbles and it cracks for a few months. But again, this is nothing to worry about, because the voice will soon be deep and steady, and a little time is needed to complete this development of the vocal cords. And now, as I've stated, practically every part of your body is affected in one way or another by puberty. Even your skin will undergo major changes, whether you're a boy or a girl. In fact, this is probably the most distressing aspect of all the physical events that take place in early adolescence. One study of 2,000 teenagers that I saw asked the question, "What do you most dislike about yourself?" And skin problems outranked every other reply by a wide margin. Now, these skin eruptions occur primarily as a result of an oily substance that is secreted during adolescence. And the pores of the skin tend to fill up with this oil and they become blocked. And since the oil can't escape, it hardens there and it causes what's called pimples or blackheads. And you might expect to have these imperfections on your skin for several years, although some cases are much milder than others. A few kids go through adolescence and don't have skin problems at all. The vast majority do. It's probably best to expect them.
Now, of course, there's much more to the section where Dr. Dobson talks specifically to boys and about the changes that will occur for boys. But I'm going to skip ahead, and we're going to listen to a portion where he now talks about the transitions that occur for a young woman's body. And, of course, again, the boy who's driving with you, or the girl who's driving with you or on this trip with you and talking about preparing for adolescence, should listen to both of these with you, because they need to understand what's happening to both the boy and to the girl. So let's transition into a segment where we're going to hear Dr. Dobson talking about what happens, the changes that happen to a girl as she enters puberty.
Now, let's talk about the many changes girls will experience during the years of puberty. A girl's body goes through even more complex changes than those of a boy, because it has to prepare itself for the very complicated task of motherhood. The way a woman's body functions to produce human life is one of the most beautiful mechanisms in all of God's universe. Now, in order to meet those requirements, a girl's body undergoes many changes during puberty. The sexual awakening, the changes we've been talking about, make it possible for a girl to carry a baby and become a mother after puberty. Now, one of those important developments is called menstruation, which you've probably heard about. Now, this is a subject that girls need to understand thoroughly in the days ahead. Most schools, in fact, provide this information to girls in either the fifth or the sixth grade. So what I'll tell you now may be just kind of a review for you, a review of what you've seen and heard elsewhere. However, I feel it's also important for boys to understand this process too, although they are seldom informed properly. So whether you're male or female, boy or girl, listen carefully as I explain what's actually taking place in menstruation. When a woman becomes pregnant, and by that I mean when that one-celled zygote has been planted in her uterus after having sexual relationship with a man, her body begins to protect that embryo and to help it grow. It has to have oxygen and food, and it has to have many chemicals which are necessary for life. And these substances are delivered to the uterus automatically through the mother's blood. But you see, and this is a very important point. You're going to have to listen carefully or I'll confuse you. Since the uterus has no way of knowing when a new life is going to be planted there, it has to get ready to receive that embryo each month just in case it happens. Therefore, blood accumulates on the walls of this special pouch on this uterus in order to nourish an embryo if the woman becomes pregnant. But if she doesn't become pregnant that month, then the uterine blood is not needed. It's unnecessary. And it is released from the walls of the uterus, and it flows out through the vagina, that special opening through which babies are also born. And this happens every month, every 28 days, although that number varies a bit from person to person. A woman's body will get rid of this unnecessary blood, which would have been used to nourish a baby if she'd become pregnant. It usually takes about 3 to 5 days for the flow of this blood to stop, and during this time she wears a kind of cloth pad to absorb the blood, and the process is called menstruation. Now, there's some very important attitudes that I want you to understand through this discussion. First, menstruation is not something for girls to dread or fear. Since the subject of blood, you know, causes us to shudder. Anytime you see blood or mention blood, people say, "Ooh, I don't want anything to do with that." Because of that, some girls get very tense over this process happening to them, and they start worrying about it and dreading its arrival, and they're embarrassed about it, and some don't want it to happen at all. But actually, menstruation makes possible the most fantastic and exciting event that can ever occur, and by that I'm referring to the creation of a new human being. Now, let me make this final statement. Girls, don't worry about this aspect of your health. You will not bleed to death, I promise you. Menstruation is not an abnormal thing. It's as natural as eating or sleeping or any other bodily process. But if you feel you are abnormal in some way, if you're worried about some aspect of menstruation, if you think you're different or that maybe something has gone wrong, or if there's pain associated with menstruation, or if you have any question at all, then muster your courage and talk to your mother or your doctor or someone with whom you have confidence. In about 98 cases out of 100, the fears will prove to be unjustified, and you'll find that you're completely normal and that the trouble was only in your lack of understanding of the mechanism. Now, obviously, other things begin to happen to the body at about the same time that menstruation occurs for a girl. You probably will also have a growth spurt just prior to your first menstruation. Incidentally, the average age of the first menstruation in American girls is now about 12 and a half years of age, but it can occur as early as 9 or as late as 16 or 17. The age varies widely from girl to girl. Now, during this time, your body will become very rounded and curvy like your mother's, so some structural physical changes are going to take place around the time that your first menstruation occurs. Your breasts will enlarge, and they may become sore occasionally, and boys sometimes experience this soreness as well. This doesn't mean that you have a disease or cancer or some other complication, but simply that your breasts are changing like everything else in your body. Hair will also grow under your arms and on your legs and in the pubic region as with boys. Now, these are the most obvious physical changes that take place, and when you see them happening, you can kiss goodbye to childhood. It's full speed ahead toward adulthood.
Now, as I mentioned at the beginning of this podcast, you may want to break the talk into two talks, actually. The Preparing for Adolescence talk, where you get into all the bodily changes and all of what's coming. But then when they're a little bit older, having a specific conversation and a specific experience with your young person about the issue of purity and the commitments that they will make to living a life of purity, particularly as it relates to their sexual lives as they enter those dating years, or actually a little before they enter those dating years. I think you want to capture it when they're still younger. So maybe when the child is, let's say, 13 or 14, perhaps 12, but somewhere in there where they're starting to think about and interested in dating the opposite sex, whether you're ready to let them date or not, it's really important to talk to them about purity and why you have the philosophy you do about their dating experiences. So there's another resource I'm going to introduce you to now, produced by Dennis Rainey of Family Life Ministries. They have a series, it's actually a packet called Passport to Purity, and it's designed for something very similar, a trip and an experience together between parent and child, father and son, mother and daughter, or single parent with either sex, to talk about these issues. And again, like with Dr. Dobson's resource, they produce something that you can listen to together and let them say the hard thing and let them introduce some of these topics, and then you unpack it together. So again, as a way of giving you a sense of what that conversation may sound like, or to give you a taste of this resource in case you want to use it with your child, I'd like to move into a segment that's produced, again, by Dennis Rainey and the Family Life team, talking about the issue of purity with your young person.
Now, what I'm going to do for the rest of this session is hopefully cause you to really think. I mean, really think through and talk about what your boundaries, what your standards are going to be about your virginity and physical affection prior to marriage.
Even before you get into the official dating stage, according to the standards of our society, you're supposed to have kissed.
And so I think people are easily persuaded by the world's view of purity, and it's not necessarily reality, but that's their only example. And then hormones, of course.
I think that some girls assume that, like, the further they go with a guy, the more committed he'll be to the relationship.
In my first couple relationships, I felt like I was doing good if we weren't having sex.
Well, you can never take it back.
But I did do things beyond kissing in one of my relationships, and it really affects you emotionally.
It shows that the bar is getting pushed closer and closer to the final limit.
It's easier to mess up than you think when you start getting your heart involved.
In a way, it kind of forces you to draw a line. You either have to establish from the beginning that I'm okay with kissing someone because that's what's expected, or I'm absolutely not okay with kissing someone and I have a specific point at which that's going to be okay.
In my personal opinion, I think it's more romantic to wait if there's only one guy I hold hands with or one guy I kiss, and that's my husband.
If you're just looking at that line, it's, oh, we haven't had sex, you know, we haven't kissed, we haven't held hands, we haven't whatever, you know, we're not doing this.
It's the difference between wanting to be better versus wanting to be not bad.
There's only so much trouble you can get in when you're, you know, in public places or you have friends around.
It should always be what is honoring God. And so it's important to definitely think beforehand and talk to the person you're dating about.
I think it really helps at the beginning of any relationship. You need to let them know what to expect and what not to expect.
I myself have made a decision that I don't plan on kissing anyone until I get engaged to her.
You're protecting your heart and you're protecting the heart of your future husband.
Almost without fail, when I tell people that, they're shocked that I wouldn't kiss someone that I was just dating.
And that was really encouraging to me because it was something that I didn't have to worry about because I knew that he was going to lead me and that he was going to lead me in the right direction.
Like, if I'm going to date somebody, I want God to be in the relationship too.
I can hear you asking at this point, what in the world is sexual purity? What are you talking about here? Well, I'm not going to answer it fully right now, but it means going nowhere near the edge of that cliff. It means to save the gift, that special gift of your virginity that God's given you, until you can give it to another person within the commitment and the covenant relationship of marriage. And let me promise you something. When you do that, when you hold on to your standards, first of all, you're not going to experience the shame, the guilt, the emotional scars that come with wrong choices. You're going to have a clear conscience. In fact, there's not going to be any chance of somebody getting pregnant. And also, there are some very serious diseases that you can get if you're involved in sex outside of marriage. And some of those diseases can even kill you. If you don't have sex before marriage, you're not going to get those diseases. It's really important that you as a young man honor a young lady by not touching her body in places where you ought not to be touching her.
And you know what? The same is true for girls. Young women shouldn't touch a young man's body in an inappropriate place. Now, you might be sitting there thinking, yuck, I never want to do that anyway. But remember, we've been talking about change, and change is coming. And someday you will be tempted to give in to some very strong desires that you will feel. Sometimes touching the opposite sex begins somewhat harmlessly, at least it seems. In junior high and high school, you're going to have friends who are going to start playing these little games with each other. They're attracted to one another as boys and girls, and so they find ways to touch each other that seem innocent, like tickling one another or wrestling with one another in a playful way. Sometimes they'll give each other back rubs or hugs, or they'll sit on one another's laps. The problem with this is that some of this touching can be exciting. It can feel good, and that physical touch can arouse your sex drive. Now, you may think it sounds maybe kind of old-fashioned that I can't play tickle games, but we want to remind you, your goal is to protect your virginity and remain sexually pure. You want to stay as far away from the edge of the cliff as you can, and so avoiding these little playful games between boys and girls is a good way to do that.
Now, at this point, I can almost read your mind. You're thinking that my wife Barbara and I are a couple of fuddy-duddies, and that we were born in some other era and are so old-fashioned. Well, you know what? If you thought what we shared before, you're going to think we're off our rocker. I want to encourage you to keep your lips off of the opposite sex. Now, here's what you need to know about kissing. There are two kinds of kisses, two very very different kisses. There's a kiss that says, hey, I kind of like you. I'm fond of you. You're kind of a special person to me. And then there's another kind of kiss. Look at your parent right now. They're likely nodding. That kiss is a passionate kiss. Now, trust me on this. That first kind of kiss, you know, the harmless one, it can turn into a passionate kiss in a nanosecond. A passionate kiss says, I'm more than like you. In fact, I'm looking for something from you. Now, what I'm saying here is the same thing I said to a young man who asked my daughter to go out to the prom. I met with him a few days before they went to the prom, and I looked him straight in the eyes, and you're not going to believe this, but I asked him, I said, I'd like to ask you to help honor my daughter, and my request for you is to protect her innocence, protect her purity. And I looked him straight in the eye and I said, now, you've probably noticed that my daughter is very beautiful. She's very pretty and attractive. And what I'd like to ask you to do, and I paused, is not kiss her. I'd like to ask you to keep your lips off my daughter. I wish you could have been there. He turned kind of red, and I wasn't sure if he was going to pass out or not. He was kind of embarrassed, and wasn't easy for me to say either, by the way, but it was kind of tough to have that conversation. But I have to tell you, after we were done at the end of the time, we had a great conversation. We walked out together. We were shaking each other's hands, and I told him how proud I was that he'd come to talk to me as a young man talking to a dad before he took my daughter to the prom. And here's the cool thing. I think they had a wonderful time at the prom. And no, I don't think he kissed her either. Okay, I know what you're thinking and probably asking. As a young man, you're probably saying, are you saying I should never kiss a girl? Or as a young lady, I shouldn't kiss a guy? Well, before I answer that, I want you to listen to this couple's story.
I remember when I was in seventh grade and I had a girlfriend, and there was a lot of pressure from our friends to for us to kiss and for us to kind of, I guess, consummate a seventh grade relationship. And to the extent that her friends would even begin to coordinate these kind of like these moments to say, okay, now you can kiss. And they would go run behind, you know, they would kind of put us together and then they'd go run behind the building or something. And that relationship ended pretty shortly thereafter. And when I made that decision to, I guess, to not kiss anybody until I knew it was going to be my wife, I didn't see the point really of dating in junior high. So I had a lot of friends that were girls and we hung out, you know, at lunch and the football games and basketball games and that sort of thing. But she was my kind of my last official girlfriend until Stephanie and I got together, until we started dating. I met Stephanie at church, at a church plant. I moved to Nashville, Tennessee after college, and she was visiting one of her friends. And the first day that I met her, she was coming out of the church office and I was coming into the church office. Being the new guy to town, I just went up to her and introduced myself and said hello and actually made fun of her because of the way that she was animated and talking to me. I didn't know what to do with her animation, so I just kind of did it back at her, even though that wasn't me.
He approached me with confidence and dignity and was just looked me in the eye, said hello, introduced himself, and was just funny. I guess him imitating me made me endure it. I don't know. There was something endearing about
it was
that.
Memorable.
Made it memorable. Yeah. I got in the car. I was going out of town and I talked about him for the next 45 minutes to my girlfriend. And told her, okay, this sounds too hokey. I can't say he's the guy I'm going to marry, but I want to marry a guy like him. And because if I say he's the guy I'm going to marry, that's just like too movie-ish.
He's the one! I just know it! Oh, be still my beating heart.
So I said, a guy like him.
Our first date was on New Year's Eve of that year. So 4 months later after we had met was our first date.
He just kind of told me, this is who I am, this is what I'm about, and I don't play games. And so if I'm pursuing a girl, I'm taking everything we do very seriously. And I'm not just doing it for a period of time or to have fun or, you know, I'm being very intentional about what I'm doing. I got butterflies. I was like, yay, me. I felt like, okay, so this is what a man is like. So after I kind of got over the initial shock of him being so upfront with how, you know, how he felt, because basically he was taking me out. So he was saying, I have feelings for you. And I'm not going to play with your emotions, and I'm not going to play with my emotions. And there was just a confidence of, wow, this just feels so nice. It feels very, I just felt very respected.
The decision to not kiss anybody until my wedding day came from, I think, my experiences as a boy growing up with all my friends doing things maybe that I didn't think I wanted to do, grew up with some conversations in my family about what was respectful to the opposite sex, what wasn't, my experiences with my first girlfriend in seventh grade. So my decision to not kiss anybody until my wedding day came from a conglomeration of experiences and realizing that I wanted my first kiss to be meaningful.
In past relationships, within probably two or three dates, we were kissing and holding hands and, you know, hanging out on the couch, snuggling, pretty quick. And there was just this level, I always felt that it wasn't right, but there was also the other feeling that it felt good. And so I always wrestled with the two.
Can you say more about what was wrong about it? Was the kissing wrong?
Was the kissing wrong? What I wanted to, what it made me want to do past kissing, I felt was wrong. You start one place and you just want to go more and more because it just feels, it's like a drug. And I wanted more of the drug each time. It was definitely different with Samuel. I just felt completely respected. I felt like I could be with him and not have to
be on guard. So it let a lot of my guard down, and we were really able to go deep, quick with who we were and our relationship on a totally different level than I'd ever gone with any guy before, because the guys weren't interested in me before. They were interested in making out.
My first kiss was the highlight of the wedding. For me, it was, because, you know, it was this moment that the tension had just been building up for, what, 15 years? And so when I got the go-ahead from the pastor, I went for it, and I gave her the biggest kiss I think she maybe has ever had.
Oh, yeah. Yes, it was quite impressive. And because before we got on stage, I was like, okay, we're just going to do a little kiss on stage, right? Like, because we're going to do this for the first time in front of 300 people. He was like, yeah, little. And then we got up there, and it was like, whoa.
Samuel, you may now kiss your bride. Learner.
We continued to kiss all the way down the aisle. I think we stopped at least three times while we walked down the aisle to kiss.
Isn't that a cool story? You know, over the years, I've met and talked to dozens of young couples who have made a similar commitment, and when they got married, they had no regrets. But I'm especially proud of that particular couple. Can you guess why? Well, their names are Samuel and Stephanie Rainey. That's right, Samuel is our son, and I was there to witness his very first kiss. I've also talked to a lot of couples who didn't make that commitment, and I can tell you, they're not proud of all the people they kissed and of all the passion they expressed that they wish they'd held on to until they were married. Here's the point for you. If you don't decide where you're going to draw the line and how far you're going to go near the edge of the cliff, or how far away from the edge of the cliff you're going to be, then you'll be giving away your innocence and purity to another person, one step at a time. That person, more than likely, is not going to be your husband or your wife. Well, what we've challenged our children to do with their purity is we've encouraged them to save all of it for their spouse. That's why we challenged them to consider saving their first kiss to be their wedding kiss. That meant that they needed to draw a line close to the mountain, as far away from the edge of the cliff as possible. Now, I can hear you saying again, Mr. Rainey, that sounds absolutely absurd. None of my friends do that. Well, you know what? Not a lot of the friends of our children do it either. We didn't force our children to make this decision. It was fully their choice, and we let them make that decision. But we did ask them to decide where they are going to draw the line to protect their moral purity and preserve their innocence and virginity for marriage. You see, you are about to experience your teenage years in what has become a sexually charged culture. You aren't going to get much encouragement or help from anybody else to protect your innocence or your virginity. That's why I'd ask you to consider, why don't you wait and save your first kiss? Now, I can hear you saying again, are you saying that holding hands and kissing are wrong? Here's the deal. I'm not saying that at all. What I am saying is that why start something that you're going to have to stop? I'm also saying this. I think that passionate kissing and hugging and touching in private places isn't right. God's Word clearly commands us to abstain from every form of sexual immorality. If you want to make sure that you're going to stay sexually pure, then draw that line as far from the edge of the cliff as you possibly can.
Well, as we said at the beginning, these can be awkward conversations, but boy, are they important for the parent to have with the child to both prepare them for what's ahead, to help them make commitments, but also as part of their faith path, their faith formation path. You see, who we are as men and who we are as women, created in God's image for a purpose as it relates to marriage and family, are a vital piece of giving them a vision of what it means to live a Christian walk as they mature. And so this isn't just something to talk about the biology. This isn't just something to talk about how to stay out of trouble. This is something to give them a stronger, deeper sense of their identity as one made in the image of God for a purpose, both male and female. So we encourage you to take that step with your child. Have those talks with your child. We hope this tool is helpful as you do so. We hope you also will take advantage of some of the other tools that are available to you for those purposes. I want to specifically mention the two resources I excerpted on this podcast. The first came from Preparing for Adolescence, the Family CD Pack by Dr. James Dobson. The copyright is from the year 2000 by Gospel Light Publications. All rights reserved, use by permission, etc. And I do want to give them thanks for allowing me to excerpt that great resource. I encourage you to take advantage of it if you're planning that kind of a conversation with your child. Also, I want to thank Dennis and Barbara Rainey for permission to excerpt portions of Passport to Purity, a kit that they've produced there. In fact, I encourage you to visit familylife.com, where you can learn more about planning a Passport to Purity experience with your child in coming days. You can do it. It may be awkward, but it's going to be worth it. Get it on the calendar. Schedule something. Have fun. Make it light, but also make it clear. And you'll be so glad that you did. And in years to come, so will your child, even though they may turn a little green in the process. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.